Tasmanian Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
And coming up today, meat producers looking at big changes to their operations as the changing climate pushes alternative farming practices.
We'll do with and without adaptations, and then we'll do historical climates and future climates. And when we just simulate the effect of future climates with their current farming systems, what we'll see is the impact of climate change. And what we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years is about a 10 to 15% reduction in productivity with no adaptation.
And a very busy time over the holiday period for one Northwest fish processor.
That week leading up to Christmas, it just hit top gear, and between Christmas and New Year, I'm pretty confident a lot of our little places was probably 25% up on trade, and people just come out and about. It was fantastic.
A story coming up later in the Country Hour, and we'll try and find out how much rain has fallen in the state when we talk to the Bureau a little bit later. By the way, let us know what's in your rain gauge. 0438 922 936 is our number, 0438 922 936. Well, as climate becomes more varied and extreme, a new national project for the red meat industry is looking at how farmers can remain profitable and sustainable into the future. Dr. Matthew Harrison from the University of Tasmania has told Hugh Hogan farmers might have to make drastic changes to their current practices.
The idea is to use what we call regional working groups, and so therefore ground our work in producer needs and reality. And so we'll go out there and say, what's a representation of our existing farming systems, and then therefore set up our models based on, you know, some representative farms. And that's also the case with our adaptations. So we say, what sort of adaptations would you potentially overlay or potentially implement on your farms? And that might be changing your pasture species to a deep-rooted pasture species, which might increase carbon sequestration. It might be planting a portion of your farm to trees, which will increase carbon sequestration. It might be, in the north, for example, changing livestock genotype, not so much in Tasmania, but in Queensland, and so that might be more adapted to heat stress. And so changing from Bos taurus to Bos indicus, for example, and there's a whole bunch. And so what we can do is we can do single adaptations in the model and the effect of those, but we can also overlay them to see the cumulative effect.
How drastically will farmers have to change their business models to survive in the new climate?
That's a key question that we want to answer in the project. So we'll do with and without adaptations, and then we'll do historical climates and future climates. And when we just simulate the effect of future climates with their current farming systems, what we'll see is the impact of climate change. And what we've seen in the last 10 to 15 years is about a 10 to 15% reduction in productivity with no adaptation. And what we've seen is that the impact of climate change and increasing variability of climate is that the impact has been worse than more than what we've predicted.
It's a bit worrying.
It is, yeah. And so that's that. What the climate models, we've done this work for probably 10 or 15 years, and our predictions for 2050 and 2040 have come out now. So that's what we're seeing in 2020.
So it sounds like drastic change is going to be needed.
Yeah, so pretty big change, but that's highly regionally specific. So in the south, and particularly the coastal areas of Tasmania and Victoria, we have less impact, so rainfall is less impacted, but we see a big reduction in rainfall and an increase in the magnitude of heat stress days in Victoria.
This is also tied into the red meat industry's goal of being carbon neutral by 2030, is that right?
Yeah, so what we can do, and 2030 is not far away now, only 10 years away, so what we can do, we're essentially in an ideal position to model pathways to carbon neutrality. So what we can do is set up the existing number of animals on a farm, their pasture type, their diesel inputs, their electricity use, the number of trees that they have, and essentially work out a baseline emissions. And that might be, just making it up, but 100 tonnes of CO2 emissions, CO2 equivalents per year. And then we can say, okay, what adaptations or what implementations can we do to reduce that amount such that we get to zero by 2030? And so that can be planting a portion of the portion of the farm to trees. It could be installing solar panels. It could be buying carbon credits from another farm, so like a conglomerate. It could be a range of factors. And so we can model individual or cumulative factors. And the other thing that we're looking at is transformational adaptations. And so that's massive or complete changes to the farming systems. And they're long-term high-risk adaptations, and we're not advocating that any of the farmers that we work with implement them, but we can essentially model them. So we work with some of the leading farmers and industry people and say, but also people from different industries like human research, and say, to get different ideas and say, okay, so what are some of the, you know, radical changes that we might do to the farming system? And that might be completely changing the livestock type. So it might be from ruminants to non-ruminants, beef to kangaroos or something, or it could be including, you know, technology, wind farm or solar panels or something like that.
They're pretty drastic changes. How do you think that'll go down?
Probably not well, but as I say, because we've got both a very practical applied end to the project, but we've also got a very theoretical end, so that's the transformational end. But part of the project is social research. So we've done quite a lot of social research and interviews already to get essentially what issues farmers are facing now and what they could potentially implement, you know, to mitigate greenhouse gas emissions but also adapt to climate change. And that's the idea of the regional working groups as well, so that the modelling is very much informed by what the industry wants and needs. And so what we'll do is we'll get their needs for a start, we'll have a go at modelling, and essentially we always get the modelling wrong at the start, and then we go back to them and say, are these animal productivity numbers and pasture productivity roughly what you see on your farm? And if it's not, we adjust the model to it so that it replicates reality. And then we go and change something, and then we go back to them and say, okay, now this is what happens if you change your pasture type to your stocking rate, to the number of animals that you run. So it's essentially an iterative participatory process so that both the researchers learn but also the end users learn at the same time.
It's Dr. Matthew Harrison, Senior Scientist at the Tasmanian Institute of Agriculture, talking there to Hugh Hogan about the Nexus project, which is between the CSIRO, the University of Melbourne, University of TAS, and Meat and Livestock Australia. Big project there. Coming up in the Country Hour, a look at the future of the coal industry. And I've got a message from Glenn. He's received 16 millimetres of rain at Fawcett up until midday. So that's a fairly decent fall in an area which probably does need some rainfall. And also, if you see some choppers down in the Huon Valley around the Castle Forbes Bay and Lucaston area, some low-flying choppers, they're drying off the cherries. A little bit of rain down in the Huon Valley as well. Let us know how you're going. 0438 922936 is our text line number, 0438 922936. Well, it's expected bushfire-affected wool will start to make its way into the market over the next few weeks. For many farmers and wool classes, it's unprecedented. And in response, the industry has now created new guidelines for how to classify the wool. Fiona Rawley is a class of registrar with the Australian Wool Exchange and says if classed correctly, large parts of the clip can be saved.
We haven't seen any fire-affected wool come onto the market as yet, but we've definitely had contact from our wool selling agents that their clients are saying that there will be wool coming on the market soon, and just looking for some guidance from AWEX in how to prepare the wool from those sheep that have been affected by fire.
So what advice do you have for growers?
Well, we have three potential technical faults that they may be present in the wool, depending on the exposure those sheep have had. What we're looking at is there may be burnt wool coming from. That's where the fibres have actually been damaged, and there's quite a bit of black deterioration in the wool. Some sheep may be singed, so we're looking at there might be just some damage on the tip and leaving some usable wool with less damage. And the third issue that they may experience is wool that's been charcoal affected from sheep that are running on burnt country, but there's actually no physical damage to the fibres at all.
And so what do you recommend people do if they're going to be shearing or they're going to be handling some of the sheep that have been through the bushfires that we've seen across the eastern seaboard?
Yeah, so look, wool classes may not have been faced with the situation of classing burnt wool before, and you know, certainly we don't have a prescription for that in the code of practice. So we've taken the initiative to put out some guidelines on what to do with that. So firstly, classes should apply the classing principles as they normally do, assessing the mob to gauge the level of fault that may be within that mob. So it could be that all animals are affected evenly, and if that's the case, then they just apply their classing strategy to the mob as using standard classing practices. The second part is that they may find that just there's sheep individual sheep affected within the mob or parts of fleece that need to be dealt with. If it's just a small amount of wool that's affected, then that wool would be separated and consigned to bulk class. The other thing that classes need to be mindful of is optimising that unaffected wool and to salvage any wool that has no fibre damage. Growers can assist the classer by separating the mobs that have had different exposure levels to the fire. So they may have some that have just been running on burnt country and other mobs that have actually been directly burnt and singed. So presenting those mobs as different mobs definitely helps the classer in keeping those lines distinctly different.
Is there any other advice that you'd have for people that are going and checking on their animals and assessing the quality of the wool that may be still left on them through as they go, people are starting that recovery process?
The thing that we can think of here is that charcoal effective wool, it's definitely scourable. Our buyers have indicated that wool is salvageable. The charcoal is fully scourable. So that's a bit of optimism there that's not going to have a lesser impact on the quality of the wool. But our buyers are saying that definitely want those charcoal-affected lines of wool separated from unaffected wool. I think it's really important for classes to make sure that they correctly identify that wool in the class's specification that has been affected by charcoal, or if those lines of wool have actually been burnt and have some fibre damage, because there's clearly different processing implications with those two types of wool.
Fiona Rowley, a classer registrar with AWEX, speaking there to Josh Becker about bushfire-affected wool starting to make its way into the auction markets over the next few weeks. Interesting. Coming up in the country hour, the completion at least of a cull of camels in the centre of the country. Now, Jeff from Lachlan Valley tells us that their high-quality weather station has measured 9.1 millimetres of rain to midday at 360-metre elevation. And Jeff says at one stage we had rain falling at a rate of 70 millimetres per hour in one downpour, so certainly some heavy rain.
The Tasmanian Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
0438 922 936 is our text line number. Well, it was the far south of Tasmania just 1 year ago where a number of small wineries were affected by smoke taint from the Geeveston bushfires. In Victoria, around 180 grape growers headed to Milawa yesterday as part of a workshop to better understand the effect of bushfire smoke on their wine grapes. It's still too early in the season to know if the grapes have been affected. But as Erin Somerville learnt, the winemakers are a resilient bunch and hope new technology being developed by La Trobe University will help make Australian leaders in managing smoke taint and keeping local producers on the front foot.
My name's Tracy Richards and I'm the vigneron of Howden Estate Wines in Beechworth.
What's brought you here today?
I'm just interested in learning about more of what we should be doing in the grape growing and wine industry in response to this.
How are you feeling?
At the moment the jury's out, because I don't believe we are at the position yet in Beechworth where we can make a call on whether it's going to be an issue for us or not, because we haven't gone through Verizon.
We're going to be learning today about some technology that's coming out to help grape growers. How important is it to have assets like that to keep you guys ahead of what's happening?
Oh, look, I think it's very important, because if you look at Beechworth, we had fires in 2003, 2007, 2009, now 2019-20. It's four times in the last two decades, so we need all the help we can get to deal with this situation.
How are your colleagues feeling?
At the moment, there's across the spectrum, I guess, is what I can say. So some people are feeling positive and some people are actually feeling quite despondent about the whole situation.
Is there a sense of optimism that this industry could become leaders in managing this?
I would hope so, yeah, because obviously we've got the catastrophic scenario happening here, so it's a good opportunity to learn as much as we can about what can be done.
What would smoke taint mean for your business?
It would wipe out a year's income across the board. if it was to occur.
Yeah. And how devastating would that be for the industry and particularly like smaller boutique wines like yours?
Well, obviously for me it's bad, but I think you've got to consider this in the wider economic impact, because the knock-on effect to everybody in my supply chain, both up and down, and then all the local businesses in the region are already suffering terribly. It's just not good. It's not just us.
My name's Nick Toy. I'm the winemaker at Feathertop Wines in Porepunkah, in northeast Victoria.
Around 180 people have registered today. What's brought you here?
We've had a fairly long standing need to gather as much information we can about smoke taint. Obviously, it's probably our greatest threat in the northeast here to viticulture. So this is just another line of seminars that we've been to in the last few years, but obviously at the moment it comes at a pretty critical time too, so we're trying to gather as much info as we can and have a chat to as many local people as we can as well about their experiences.
Are you worried about what this might do for your grapes?
Extremely worried, yes. Yeah, obviously the risk is pretty high at the moment, but obviously there's a lot of unknowns too about the risk at the moment with the stage of the vines and where they're at. So we're hoping to gather that information, but yes, we're absolutely very worried, yes.
We're hearing a lot about this new technology coming out, so is there a bit of optimism that, you know, grape growers might be able to know a bit more and manage this better in the future?
Yeah, knowledge is really important. All knowledge we can get at this stage, because assumptions can be really dangerous when you're talking about smoke taint. But unfortunately, there's not much we can do about it at this stage. I mean, there are some technologies coming out that we may be able to do some topical applications in the future, but they're sort of in their infancy. So we're really interested in seeing how they develop. For us, the most important thing is that research funding continues, and that's one of the reasons we're here, to support some of the people with that as well, and to push for that, because it's such an important part of what we do.
Speaking with your colleagues, how is the mood at the moment?
Pretty resilient bunch, people. I mean, as I said, this isn't the first time for a lot of these growers. This is the first major event for me. I've been in the Valley for 6 years. We have had some smoke issues with regards to planned burns, but this is the first sort of full bushfire emergency we've had, and prolonged one. They're a pretty resilient bunch, but I know there'll be a lot of, in private, there'll be a lot of downhearted people, because as I said, we pour our heart and soul into this and can be sort of taken away from us in a heartbeat. So.
And what are you hoping to get out of today?
As much knowledge as we can, and obviously just the volume of people here just makes it really a positive thing that we're all in this together, essentially, you know, and hopefully, you know, a bit more of that community spirit can come out as well, and which usually does at this time, but essentially just as much knowledge as we possibly can.
It's winemaker Nick Toy talking to Erin Somerville about the problem of smoke taint in wine. Some 180 grape growers met yesterday to discuss the bushfire smoke on wine grapes. Well, still to come in the Country Hour, a Huon Valley couple adding value to the southern dairy industry, and a busy summer period for one Tasmanian fish processor in just a moment.
Now you can hear ABC Grandstand Summer of Cricket, streaming on the ABC Listen app.
Bang, says David Warner.
Every ball.
She's bowled her.
Every wicket.
Got a shot mid-wicket.
Every men's and women's international match.
Uninterrupted.
In-depth.
All summer long.
Wherever you are.
ABC Grandstand Summer of Cricket.
Now in the palm of your hand with the ABC Listen app.
What a game!
Find out more, abc.net.au/grandstand.
On ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania, you're with Tony Briscoe for the Tasmanian Country Hour.
Well, seafood is often on the menu over Christmas and New Year, and that means it's a frantic time for fishermen. Peter Smith has stepped back from fishing over the past few years and processes gummy shark and scale fish at Wynyard. He's told Hugh Hogan demand for Tasmanian caught produce is growing.
It was pretty good again this year. It started off a bit slow, especially with all the wind and that we had in November. Just a few of our customers said things were a bit quiet, but that week leading up to Christmas, it just hit top gear, and between Christmas and New Year, I'm pretty confident a lot of our little places was probably 25% up on trade when people just come out and about. It was fantastic.
That's a big jump.
It is actually, yeah, and and whether that was because things were a bit slow and everyone held back a little bit, but yeah, it was quite noticeable. In the smaller little takeaway shops and the fish shops and that we deal with, and that there was a really good demand for especially gummy shark over that Christmas period.
What do you think's driving that demand?
Whether it's people are starting to realise that gummy is an excellent product and a great quality fish to eat, or whether whether there's a lack of other fish on the market at the time, which that can happen as well due to the weather. And I'm sort of just saying I think people are just starting to realise that gummy, it's good eating.
And you mentioned scale fish. How have they been this season? You do a little bit, I understand.
Yeah, the scalies are a bit hit and miss. We had a few stripy trumpeter there come in just before Christmas, which was a great for the customers, obviously. A little bit of a choice there to choose from. But it has been a bit hit and miss this year. The water temperature was a little bit late heating up. Finally, it has kicked into gear, and that's probably due to all the wind we had in November kept the water temperature down. But what it did create was the quality of our fish that we were getting were really good because they were still in that cooler water. But I'm thinking from now on there'll be a fair bit more scale fish kicking around.
With all that wind in spring and the weather's been up and down and everywhere recently, have the boats been able to get out enough?
Yeah, they've pushed the boundaries a little bit, but when they've had that opportunity of that little break in the weather, they've gone out and worked pretty hard. Like, they've probably worked a few more extra hours a day because they're limited. But we did find a supply, and supply seems to be hitting the demand, which is good. But yeah, it was a bit testing there for a little bit of time.
Where's most of your product ending up?
Most of our product stays in Tassie. Well, actually, the 100% stays in Tassie. It's whether it's the local pub or it's a fish shop down the wharf here at Wynyard, or we sell product in Petunia, Hill Street, PD Wholesalers. It sort of finds its way all around, a lot of pubs and clubs, and yeah, so we just wholly and solely just want to keep our product here.
A lot of the seafood in Australia comes from overseas. Your product is not only Australian but Tasmanian. Are you finding people are willing to pay a bit more for that, or is that something they're looking for?
Yeah, I think it's about the education now. People starting to realise that if you want a top quality product, you will be prepared to pay a little bit more for it. So, and I think that's where, and I think as, you know, overseas product, as the demand gets there, the price is slowly is creeping up. So where there was a big gap between our price and the imported product, I think it's becoming a bit more close together now. And I'm convinced people are prepared to pay for product, a quality product.
Probably 3 years ago now, made the move into the processing after a lifetime of fishing. Do you miss it at all?
No. There's probably times I do, but I think majority of the time now I've been able to get a life and do things outside of fishing, which I thoroughly enjoy, especially with a couple of kids growing up and that. And yeah, it's one of those things. Once you stop loving doing something, it's probably time for change.
Absolutely. Do you have anything to do with any of the boats you buy from now?
I still communicate, obviously, with a lot of the skippers on those boats. Anything I can pass on with a little bit of knowledge that might help them catch a few more fish, I'm quite happy to do.
How do you think the fishing industry up here in the northwest is going?
I think it's, especially because it's managed under a pretty strict quota system, it seems to be ticking away quite well. We're not seeing anything unusual. As I said, the quality of fish this year, because of that, has been exceptional. We're still seeing the bigger males come through when they normally come through. And, yeah, I think it's just, especially the gummy shark fishery, and I am hearing some good reports on there's a lot of school shark on the West Coast, which is showing signs of it's regenerating back to the stocks that they're looking at, which is, I think it's just all plus and positive for the fishery.
It's Peter Smith from Just Landed at Wynyard in the Northwest talking to Hugh Hogan about the busy period over the summer fish processing. Coming up in the country hour, from panel beating to converting a hobby with plants into a nursery. The controversial cull of feral camels in the APY lands of Central Australia has wrapped up, with more than 5,000 camels now dead. The aerial cull over 5 days aimed to reduce the pressure on the environment and help people living in remote indigenous communities who said the camels were increasing in numbers and damaging local infrastructure in their hunt for water. When the cull became publicly known last week, It generated international headlines and calls from various animal rights groups to stop the shoot. APY General Manager Richard King says the cull was a success and supported by the locals.
It's the first cull that we've had in APY for feral animals of any sort. And the fact that we were able to bring our stakeholders together in one place on one mission and also get approval from Anangu to proceed with the cull makes it a success. And the fact that we were able to get all of the animals that were in the area was fantastic.
Did you get as many animals as hoped? There was a target of 10,000 sort of raised in the media earlier in the week. How many did you actually end up shooting?
We ended up shooting around 5,000, just a bit over 5,000. We had a bit of rain before the cull, which always disperses the numbers. So what happens with camels is they come into one central water point when it's very dry, and they're able to, they congregate, and we're able to get them in the one spot. Otherwise, they spread out all over the country. So when you get rain, that disperses them. So that's what happened. 2 days before, it rained, and they moved out, and we're able to get what we got, but weren't able to get them all, which is fine. We'll get another chance next year.
And how many camels do you think are out there, and does this sort of leave a pretty big dent in that population?
No, it unfortunately doesn't leave a dent at all. What we've got out there, from estimates from government sources, say there's about 600,000 camels out there. So killing 5,000 of them is not much, really, compared to the grand scheme of things. So we're less than 1%.
And it can cost a lot, obviously, in terms of airtime in the chopper and as well as a shooter. Can you give us a bit of an idea of what the cull cost in its entirety?
Look, we were able to work with our stakeholders to get some funding to help us to do the cull. Some of them are private stakeholders and others are government, like NRM, who were able to come to the party. APY also put some money in. Look, overall cost, I couldn't tell you exactly what it was, but it's not a cheap exercise, but in the long run, it will actually protect the country and the animals and also protect our infrastructure. So in the long run, it's a cheaper way to manage our infrastructure by getting rid of the main cause of it, the devastation to land, but also the devastation to infrastructure that we have out there.
There was criticism from Armada community leaders around the lack of consultation. Are there people in other communities who felt the same way about this move to cull the camels?
There were three people in Armada who disagreed, and all of those people have an interest in camels and catching camels and selling camels. There are also members in that community who wanted the cull to go ahead. In the end, whenever you get one or two people saying no, well, you tend to listen to that, and we'll do that. But at the end of the day, those two or three people are going to be held to account moving forward in terms of camels. If camels are in an area devastating, those people will be contacted to get out there and sort them out. And as they wanted camels to stay, it's going to be their responsibility now to sort them out.
And, I mean, there was obviously a big public outcry from some animal rights activists. What's your response to their concerns?
Oh, look, everyone has concerns. When we're sitting around our homes, on the other side of the world, or sitting in air conditioning in the cities on our keyboards, typing out this is a terrible thing that's happening. People just have to realise that in the real world, people are living with the real situation, and it's easy for someone to sit at their keyboard in the city, enjoying the city lifestyle, to tap out a few words and be all up in arms about what's happening. I challenge any of those people to sit out there in the community with 50 degree heat, not being able to put their air conditioner on for a day, and let's see what their attitudes are then.
That's APY Lands General Manager Richard King on the camel cull in Central Australia. Time now to check the latest on the weather. Matthew Thomas joins us from the Bureau. G'day, Matthew.
G'day, Tony.
Good to see that rain falling. Did a lot of Tasmania get that so far, or is there still more to come?
Look, to 9 a.m, there was some rainfall reported about most parts of Tasmania, apart from the northern Midlands, and typical amounts were around 1 to 2 millimetres, a little bit less about the parts of the east coast. But in the southeast, where we saw some impressive thunderstorms this morning, there were some larger amounts, and we saw 30 millimetres reported at Cannells Hill, 25 millimetres at Mertz Hill in the Upper Derwent Valley, and 16 millimetres at Ouse and Lucaston. So there were some quite good falls there. And since 9 a.m. we have seen some rainfall, mainly about southeast or central parts of the state. And the highest amount has been 17 millimetres at Mount Seymour, which is just to the southeast of Oatlands. And we've seen 9 millimetres at Tea Tree Point and Campania, and 8 millimetres at Tunnock Fire Station.
Oh, good. So those areas definitely need it. And there's more to come on the way this afternoon?
Look, we've seen the thunderstorms that progressed through the northern Midlands. We expect to see them over the northeast into the early afternoon, and then clearing away later in the afternoon. We have just recently cancelled the severe thunderstorm warning. We haven't seen any larger or heavier rainfall amounts or rainfall rates in the last few hours. So we've cancelled that warning, but we will continue to monitor the situation, and if we do feel it necessary, we'll reissue that. The current situation, we've got a trough about the northeast of the state, which is really where the storms are triggering on, and that will move away out of the state later this evening. Southerly flow persisting over most of the state well into the evening. A high pressure system is building south of the Bight, and that will extend a ridge to the south of Tasmania tonight, and the high will then move to the south of Tasmania through tomorrow. We'll see a trough extend down from the mainland down over northern Tasmania later tomorrow. But for the remainder of today, we'll see some showers about the south and the east, contracting back to the south and the east coasts late in the evening. The thunderstorms about the northeast until mid-afternoon. We might see some isolated falls of 10 to 20 millimetres under these thunderstorms if they are slow moving, but typically the amounts will be around 5 to 10 millimetres. General amounts about the northeast, 5 to 15 millimetres, less than 2 millimetres elsewhere. We're not seeing terribly much about the west, and there's mostly clear skies at the moment about the northwest of the state. Into tomorrow, with that high pressure system sitting to the south of the state, should be fine apart from the chance of some early light showers about the south and east coasts, with an east to southeasterly stream. Rainfall amounts of less than 1 millimetre, so not terribly much about. That high pressure system will remain to the south on Saturday. We'll see some light showers about the east and pushing into the far northwest, but fine elsewhere, and rainfall amounts on Saturday also less than 1 millimetre. On Sunday, a low pressure system during the morning will pass to the east of the state. We'll see some morning showers about the east. Should be mainly fine elsewhere until some showers develop over central parts of the state in the afternoon and evening. And rainfall amounts should be less than 2 millimetres, mainly about the east and the central plateau. Into Monday, a low pressure system will begin to form over Victoria, and that will have some impact on our weather through Monday and Tuesday. We'll see some showers about the east and the northwest, extending to the east, the north and central parts of the state in the afternoon, although there will be little about the southwest. Looking around 5 to 10 millimetres about the east and over King Island, 1 to 5 millimetres about the north, less than 1 millimetre though about the central parts of the state. And with that low pressure system approaching the state on Tuesday, there will be some showers about the state on Tuesday.
Okay, any warnings?
Look, we've cancelled the severe thunderstorm warning, but we do have a strong wind warning current for western coastal waters, Sandy Cape to Stanley. Strong wind warning also for eastern coastal waters, Cape Portland to Tasman Island, and for Frederick Henry, Norfolk Bays and Storm Bay. For tomorrow, though, the strong wind warnings contract to the eastern coastal waters from Cape Portland to Wineglass Bay.
Okay, coastal waters and swell.
So south to southwesterly winds, 15 to 25 knots about the west, south and east, reaching 30 knots about the northwest and also about the east. Southwest to southeasterly winds of 15 to 25 knots about northern coastal waters. Into tomorrow, south to southeasterly winds of 10 to 20 knots, although 20 to 30 knots about the east during the morning. And the winds tending easterly about the north in the afternoon with inshore afternoon sea breezes. with the swells, about the west and the south, southwesterly swell of 2 to 2.5 metres, both today and tomorrow. About the north, a confused swell below 1 metre. About the east, a southerly of 0.5 to 1.5 metres, reaching south 2 metres offshore in the south, and also a northeasterly of 1 to 1.5 metres, decaying down to around 1 metre tomorrow. The wave rider buoy at Cape Sorel shows a significant wave of 2.6 metres, a maximum wave of 4 metres, a 13-second period. At 9 a.m, Matsaika Island reported a southwesterly swell of 2.5 metres. Bruny Island, a southwesterly swell of 2 metres.
Good on you, Matthew. Thank you for that.
No worries. Bye.
See you later, Matthew Thomas, from the Bureau with the latest information. Coming up for you in the Country Hour, we'll talk to a couple of yoghurt makers in the south of the state and also a unique nursery.
The Tasmanian Country Hour with Tony Briscoe on ABC Radio Hobart and Tasmania.
An industry analyst says producers of thermal coal in Australia are likely to face a decline in revenue over the next 5 years. According to Michael Urin, senior industry analyst with Ibis World, the average industry growth since 2014 has been over 10%, but that's expected to decline over the next 5 years. He says price fluctuations in coking and steaming coal is likely to have a strong effect, along with other trends, including the value of the Australian dollar and public concern over environmental problems.
Thermal coal is expected to decrease in terms of price roughly by about 3% over the next year. So that's roughly from an average of about $74 a tonne to $72 a tonne. And these estimates have been made for a variety of reasons, mainly due to changes in the global marketplace for coal. So in terms of that, that means an increase in supply, or an increase in supply outpacing growth in global demand. Reasons for that are probably the big three of China, Japan and South Korea are all currently demanding lower amounts of coal for a variety of different reasons.
So let's look at 4 to 5 years. What's the outlook there for the black coal? Are conditions going to be a little challenging?
Yes. As the outlook sort of goes further into the future, the outlook becomes a bit more difficult in terms of thermal coal. And it's again due to those changes to the market conditions and market structure for coal. So we're seeing changes in terms of energy generation in a lot of different markets. With those examples I just mentioned, China, while they are maintaining a large proportion of coal generation, they're going to increasingly source that coal they use from within their domestic industry. And also, when we look at Japan and South Korea, they're increasing or bringing back their usage of nuclear power generation, so that's going to decrease their demand for coal over that outlook period.
And for coking coal, the future looks a little brighter.
In terms of this resource, it's a lot less volatile, mostly because we haven't seen that change in terms of demand. There aren't really any viable substitutes at the moment to be used for coking coal. And in terms of when looking at environmental impacts, Australia's coking coal is actually some of the most efficient and pure in the world. So that means that we actually produce, or coal that's used from our production sources is actually going to probably be more environmentally friendly compared to other sources. So that suggests that we're not going to see any significant price declines over that sort of maybe 1 to 5 year sort of outlook period for coking coal from Australia.
There's a lot of pressure being put on the coal mining industry. There's a lot of major businesses too that are pulling out of financing some of these companies. There's the climate change issue. There's the health issues associated with it. Have you taken into account any of that when you look at the long-term viability of the coal industry?
Yeah, absolutely. Changing market conditions are partly driven due to those environmental concerns. So different countries around the world are looking at cleaner sources of energy that are polluting at lower levels, as well as being driven obviously by those economic factors that we've spoken about. So as coal generation becomes comparatively less economically viable compared to renewable sources. So when looking specifically at the Australian market, it's quite hard to really predict how that's going to affect our market, just due to sort of uncertainty around government policy in terms of coal production and also future power generation sources. But it is pretty clear that there's probably going to be some effect as that policy gets developed and changes over the next few years.
So is it likely, and do you even consider a point where we won't be mining in the future to the extent we are now?
That still seems quite a way off. Although we do still mine quite a lot of thermal coal, in terms of looking at the Hunter Valley, it's estimated that anywhere between 70 to 80% of the coal produced there is thermal coal. The value, in terms of value, the metallurgical or coking coal that we produce is still quite a significant contributor to overall export demand for coal from Australia. As with those factors I mentioned before, in terms of no viable substitutes currently, other than using completely different materials for construction, it does seem that there'll be a really strong market for metallurgical coal over the future. That remains to be probably an important export market for Australia.
The demise of the industry looks like being decades away.
Yeah, in terms of thermal coal, we will see a drop-off in terms of that as a proportion of coal production within Australia. But in terms of the longer-term viability of the industry, it still remains to be quite important probably over the medium to longer term. In terms of those big three markets of China, Japan and South Korea, another market that's sort of really starting to become a bigger proportion of Australian export is India. There's been a lot of mentions of how they have a policy towards self-sufficiency in thermal coal production domestically. However, we're actually seeing significant increases in exports to that market as their demand is rising far more quickly than their ability to produce. So that's likely to provide potentially another avenue for thermal coal exports in the future.
Michael Urin from IBIS World. He's an analyst on the coal industry, talking about the immediate future of coal, talking there to Michael Pritchard. Well, one of the big strengths of Tasmanian agriculture is the continued expansion of value adding to agricultural products right across the state. Cherry drinks, powdered berries, black garlic, snap frozen fruit. They're some of the products consumers are eagerly purchasing at shops and markets. And a couple in the Huon Valley at Mountain River are continuing the tradition, making a unique dairy product which is gaining attention from consumers.
Chris Pippos, we're at Mountain River, Southern Tasmania, and this is my wife Barbara.
And Barb, you guys make something completely different to a normal farm, don't you?
We do. We make Tasmania's only pot set yoghurt.
So when did that all start?
Probably seriously 2012. That's when we started sort of, you know, the retailers approached us and we started sort of, you know, doing more markets, farmers markets, and it sort of, you know, grew like Topsy.
Where did the idea come from?
A boozy afternoon out on the lawns, contemplating the thought of going back to full-time work, which didn't appeal to me. So our girlfriend and I decided that we might try making some yoghurt at a local market and avoid going back to full-time work.
Were you watching one of these TV programs where they taught you how to make yoghurt?
No. We can thank Google for the high-end level of expertise. But no, we'd... been to the Adelaide Central Markets and they had this yogurt stall where they had all these amazing toppings poured over the top of the yogurt, and remembered that from our last visit there and thought, yeah, that's something that we'd like to replicate. We hadn't seen anything like that here in Tassie, so yeah, we thought we'd give it a go.
I think it was been a real void in southern Tasmania. Obviously most of the dairy's up north, and there was definitely a market opportunity with the premium product, and we've been, you know, had some good local support. So
yeah, and when you took local support, where does your milk come from? You don't own a dairy yourselves.
No, that's correct. Yeah, from the start, we've sourced our milk from Mount Signet Dairy, Aidan Doreen. That's the home of Two Cow Milk, and that's been great. I mean, it's a mixture of Jersey and Friesian cows, and it's really creamy, and it's just good to support the Doreens as well. In many ways, they're the sort of the last, you know, man standing in terms of, you know, dairy farms south of Hobart, down this way anyway. There's obviously one other now, but yeah, so we've had a good partnership.
And what were the early recipes like? Was it a success straight away as far as you're concerned, or did you have to learn on the job?
Well, we initially made a stirred yogurt as opposed to the pot set yogurt, and then decanted it, made it in very small mini incubators, making maybe 10 litres a week, a very small amount, and then decanting into smaller containers. And then the technology grew a bit and we decided that pot set was the way to go, yeah.
When you say pot set, what's the difference? What's a pot set yogurt?
So pot set as opposed to stirred, pot set is actually incubated within the container that you eat it. So it maintains the really high levels of probiotics. So all the healthy bacteria that you want out of yogurt that's good for your gut. There's, I think it's almost 3 to 4 times more in pot set yogurt because it's not stirred and agitated throughout the process, whereas a stirred yogurt is the sloppy, you know, more pouring consistency type yogurt.
Now, Chris, we're sitting here in amongst the bush and Mountain River, but it's not where you actually make the yogurt, is it?
That's correct. Now, it's a former goat's cheese factory at Bonnet Hill, where we've ultimately settled. I mean, we were at a couple of places prior to that, but it's a lovely space out there, just the right size for us. So we do a bit of commuting back and forth from Cygnet to Bonnet Hill. Yeah, it's worked out well. And the landlord, she was formerly a cheesemaker, and she's been a great assistance to us as well.
What do people say when you tell them you intended making yogurt first up?
Well, I guess I'm Greek, so maybe I was always destined to make yogurt. I'm not really sure. It's funny the direction that life takes you sometimes, but being a journo by trade, it was a bit of a strange transition, but it's been great. I mean, we're foodies, my wife and I, and we just love cooking. And
Barb, what did you used to do?
I worked in human services in Adelaide in newly arrived migrants, ethnic meal service. Yeah, so a complete change for me as well. But
okay, now who wants to be the descriptive one and tell us on radio, how do you make yogurt? Which one of you? Barb?
Oh, we can't give away trade secrets. Everyone's going to make it themselves, and then they're not going to buy our product.
but just briefly, tell us how it's made.
Yeah, so we pasteurise the raw milk, heat it up to a certain temperature, and then cool it down again before adding culture to the product, and then it's poured into the containers that you consume it in, and it's incubated for nearly 7 hours, so it's a long process. And then it's rapidly chilled after that 6 to 7 hours, and got a tub of yogurt.
There you go. She gave away all your secrets.
That's right. No, it is. It's a very labour-intensive process. I mean, it's all hand-poured. That's probably a reason why, not everyone's doing pot-set yogurt. But it's definitely, and also ours is not homogenised milk, so it gives it that creamy layer on the top.
Now, the market for yogurt, it's a lot of multinationals out there, and the supermarkets are chock-a-block full of them. So how do you get your niche product in Tasmania into the spots where people are going to buy it?
Yeah, I guess we're not in the big two supermarkets, but we're in with Salamaker Fresh and Hill Streets and then right down to the local butchers. So I mean, we've been lucky in a way in terms of the Hill Streets of Salamaker Fresh as being the next tier, and they're expanding. So that's been good. But, I mean, initially it was just a lot of hard work in terms of, store tasters. We do free store tasters, just getting your product out there because we didn't have a big marketing budget. And, you are up against, the big guys, and, we're not pretending that we're competing with them, but we definitely it takes a bit of work to get people to try your product.
And Barb, at social functions, when you tell people what you do, how's their reaction?
We've been doing it for so long now that I think everyone knows us as the two that make yogurt in Mountain River. Yeah, so
is it a full time job?
Not full time, no. Between the two of us, we work maybe 3 full days collectively. Right from, collecting the milk right through to delivery. We do the whole lot, but it's just Chris and I. And, so three full days, I'd say.
Any of you big yogurt eaters yourselves?
Surprisingly, we all still eat it a lot. The kids still have it in their lunchbox, and we still, have curries and marinate chicken and do all sorts of. So we consume a lot of yogurt still. Yeah, they're not sick of it yet, so that's great.
Yeah, I've got to make curries to use the yogurt, you see, so I'm actually cooking dishes so we can empty the fridge. It's getting ridiculous.
It's Chris and Barbara Pippos making yogurt in the Huon Valley there and still eating it. Well, finally today, caladiums, philodendrons and maidenhairs. If you know your plants, you know what I'm talking about. One Sunshine Coast panel beater certainly does. Ken and Robin Scott's passion for plants, especially rare ones, grew to the point where their backyard became filled with greenhouses. So they started another business.
So I'm in a little tropical paradise here in Beerwah, Ken Scott.
Thank you. Yeah, this is my latest obsession with the aroids. So the variegated monstera and anything variegated at the moment are so popular. That's a philodendron, white princess. It was only that big in May. That's how quick it's grown. It'll attach to this totem. Same as these, when they get the aerial roots, it helps them to grow up. I put some moss behind that too.
And then over here, you've got, what are we looking at over here? You've got some beautiful little maidenhairs and ferns.
This is a rare one here. It's an Anthurium. One of my customers brought it down from Rockhampton for me. It comes from Ecuador.
Wow.
She called it elephant ear, but the proper name is Trunchicola. It's got new leaf coming in the back, and it's got flowers too. If I can get some seeds off it.
Giant size one. The leaf on that's enormous.
This is beautiful. This is an Anthurium moodianum. Look at the new leaf. and the flowers on that.
Gorgeous red.
Isn't it? So the maroon on that. This is a Balawanium, used to be called Dusi. This one here is Delicious Stachum, I think they call it, and it means long leaf, up to 2 metres long.
What is it about plants that got you hooked, Ken Scott?
We just like tropical gardens. Every house we've had, we've made into tropical gardens. This was our last house. We bought this 7 years ago, and half the plants we've planted here.
And I did see, because you've got a Facebook site, I did see your before and after photos. Hello, you've been pretty busy here with the greenhouses and, it's amazing.
Crazy gardener, yeah.
Let's go into one of the big greenhouses you can...
Okay, come and have a look.
Oh, it's so beautiful.
The only thing that was here when we moved here was the big greenhouse in the backyard and that small shed there. So we've just kept building from there. Couple of little birds' nest ferns there.
A couple of little ones, they're almost as big as us.
Yeah, they are. So I grow tree ferns, a lot I grow myself from the spore.
Is that tricky to do?
I only learn, I'm only self-taught, I'm actually a panel beater by trade. So if you want to come for a wander, you can have a
very
look.
Gentle touch for a panel beater with your plants.
This is a whitey eye, drying area whitey eye.
So it's a hanging fern.
It's a basket fern.
And it's stunning. The leaves are so pretty.
They're beautiful when they come out like that. Many years ago, a friend said they used to sell these for about $20 a frond. If it had 20 fronds.
As foliage.
As a plant. If you had a plant for sale, so that would be, say, $400 worth if you... Yeah. This is a philodendron, Prince of Orange. They're beautiful things.
Got orchids as well.
Yeah, mostly maidenhairs in here. We have about 20 different types.
And we're looking, I can't even see the end of this greenhouse, so it's going stretching on for a bit there.
It's 33 metres long, 100 foot long.
And then you've got some of these. These are very popular at the moment, the hard to kill ones. Don't let them go in the garden.
Yeah, they're just a weed, but they're good in a pot.
What are they called again?
It's a pothos, whatever you pronounce it.
They do look great in a pot, but don't let them go.
You just don't put them in the ground or in the wild. This is a very... rare anthurium, Warroquianum, what they call it, queen anthurium, some tassel ferns.
What's your favourite?
Oh, I haven't got a favourite. I like the gloriosums. You know what the gloriosum is? Come down here and I'll show you. These are pink princess, our philodendron.
Oh, gorgeous splotches of pink in amongst the green on the leaves.
Variegated alocasia, that only come good. That nearly died over winter. They can be a bit touchy. That's the lemon one, like that Prince of Orange, but it's the lemon, they call it Moonlight.
Gorgeous, it's almost neon.
Philodendron, Silver Cloud.
Beautiful.
Very nice plant. This is the Gloriosum. So I've got lots of young ones growing now from cuttings, but this is their beautiful thing.
It's almost a heart-shaped leaf.
They are. And when they get about more than two leaves on, they look spectacular. Then they just get bigger and bigger. That's probably my favourite at the moment. One of the favourites anyway.
I can see why it'd be hard to choose. And how much water do you go through with this?
We've got a bore. We've got good water. It's 120 feet down or 30-odd metres down in the other greenhouse. So we've been lucky. Touch whatever.
And how much work goes into this?
7 days a week. My wife's full-time working here now too.
Oh, wow.
It's only the two of us. It's a hobby. Got out of hand. We have a few garden clubs come with bus trips. Yeah, so it's good. You get to meet so many more people too.
Isn't it amazing? You think you can carve out a small living for yourself, a modest living, with your passion.
Yeah, it is. The trouble is you don't make much money of it. You end up spending more to buy more plants. I'm as bad as the customers. I go and buy all the stuff I can try.
Typical.
Try and find, yeah.
Typical hobby getting out of hand. Ken Scott from Sunshine Coast Tropical Ferns and Foliage. And check out their website. Ending the country hour for today.